Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We have been, of course, focused properly, I believe, on China when we talk about protecting the country we love, because there are no enemies, foreign at least, that are more dangerous to our country, to our vital interests, to those of our allies and, well, the free world more generally, than is the Chinese Communist Party. We have been blessed to have the chance to work closely over the past couple of years in particular with our first guest. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, a naval intelligence officer in the course of a very distinguished 30-odd year career, finishing up as the chief of intelligence for the Pacific Fleet of the United States Navy. He has continued to be very deeply engaged in the matters that he formerly worked on in uniform in his post-military service, notably as the hub of a very important wheel, Red Storm Risen, he calls it, and as a very active contributor to the public policy debate, including, I'm happy to say, on this program. Jim Fennell, it's great to have you with us. Thank you, among other things, for your help with our Committee on the Present Danger of China. We're very proud to have you as one of our exemplary members and a very active contributor to our webinar series and more. God bless you.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be with you again.
I want to start by talking about the recent meeting between Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, and Vladimir Putin, the dictator of Russia. Our colleague Bradley Thayer has written a piece that you circulated on your platform in which he warned that this is a turning point, it seems, in the relationship between the two countries, in that Putin now seems to be very much in the role of a vassal of Xi's Communist Party. I'd be interested in your take on whether that's so, and if so, what it portends in terms of China's ambitions and confidence that it can realize them.
Yeah, Frank, I agree with what Brad wrote in his Epoch Times op-ed that was published today. And he highlighted it was, you know, kind of two major events. It was Xi's first trip out of China in over 2 years, closer to three since the virus, CCP virus started. And secondly, it was kind of this essentially a demonstration by Xi that he was the senior partner in this this alliance. The conventional wisdom in Washington is that China and Russia have a historic, the PRC and Russia have these historic animosities, and therefore they're not really close, working close together. But some of us, Brad included, we recognize that the PRC and Russia for 20 years have been working together militarily in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and they just concluded another one of their exercises, their annual military exercises this year. And also they did Vostok, which is a major Russian exercise. So we see the military alliance, and maybe early on in 20 years ago, it was the Russians that were providing the PRC with military hardware that the PRC didn't quite have, the latest technologies in fighters like flankers, or even in some destroyers like the Sovremeny class destroyer. But now 20 years on, it's China that's the major military weapons producer in many ways, and they're obviously the larger economy. And so they're starting to control some of the relationship. And it was Xi who asked Putin to delay his invasion of Ukraine in February so that they could complete the Winter Olympics in Beijing. And what we saw from this latest meeting is just a, kind of that kind of relationship. Now, neither of them would admit to that in public, and certainly the Putin wouldn't admit that inside Russia, but it seems to be clear. But I don't want to downplay the more important factor and what Brad said in the rest of his article, which is to say we, America, are facing kind of a two-front war. We're facing Russia or a threat. We're not in an actual kinetic war, but we're facing a threat from Russia, certainly as it threatens NATO and Europe, but we're also threatened by China in the Pacific. And Russia is also in the Pacific. We must not forget that they have ballistic missiles, stationed out of Petropavlovsk, and they have a very robust military capability in the East as well. So our ally Japan is very much aware of Russia's military capabilities, as well as China and what they face from the PLA and North Korea. So in a sense, America's back into what was going on in the Cold War with the Soviet Union, but now it's a combined effort between the Russians and the Chinese military, and they're working together, and we have to take that into consideration.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we have nowhere near the kinds of capabilities that we had during the Cold War, at least in terms of numbers of ships, in terms of, boots on the ground, as they say, and the capacity, at least at points during that long twilight struggle, as it was called, to deal with two major conflicts simultaneously. That's long past, I'm afraid. But one of the other things that Brad pointed out that I wanted to just tease out with you as well, Captain Fennell, is the extent to which the relationship, this no limits partnership, has essentially given Xi Jinping confidence that his periphery is more or less secured, and that therefore he can now turn his attention perhaps to doing, presumably after this upcoming party Congress, what he and Putin did, on the eve of the Olympic Games. I mean, he certainly doesn't want anything to happen between now and then, the Congress, that is, presumably. But thereafter, there's a strong reason to believe that they may have cleared the way for Xi to go after Taiwan and perhaps others, including us. What are your current thoughts on that subject, sir?
Yeah, I fundamentally agree with Brad. I mean, because of the Russian Chinese border is now not something that they both have to worry about, and they both stated in this most recent meeting in Kazakhstan that they said, we respect and support each other's core interests. That's a clear statement for those who follow China, which is to say that Putin backs Xi against taking Taiwan or the Senkakus or even the disputed territories against India. So I think what you have is a sense from Xi and the Chinese Communist Party is that their northern flank and their far western flank are secure. And so while they have some, obviously they have the military equipment and forces that have been massing along the Indian border, they don't have to worry about some kind of an invasion from Russia, and Russia doesn't have to worry about that from them. So they've come to a mutual agreement that their borders between each other are secure, and so that they're each able to focus outwardly against the areas that are most interest to them. And for China, Taiwan is the number one interest. And it's quite possible that after this party Congress and maybe after our midterms, there could be some kind of military action by Xi, especially when he looks to Washington and doesn't see much there.
Well, I wanted to come to that next, Jim. We've just got a minute before a break, but what do you think they're making of the latest, I guess the fourth time now, that Biden has said we would defend Taiwan and been countermanded effectively by his own staff?
Well, if you look at today's PRC press and China Daily, People's Daily, Xinhua, PLA Daily, Global Times, there was almost no mention of it. And the one spokesman from the PRC foreign ministry made very much of a boilerplate statement, and it didn't seem to generate much concern. So I think Beijing recognizes that whatever President Biden says, it's not fundamentally changing, as the White House spokesperson keeps saying, that it never changes our official policy.
And when you don't see that is being interpreted, I think you're in agreement with me, by them as essentially acquiescing to what the Chinese have in mind. Jim, we'll get your thoughts on that on the other side of a very short break. We'll be right back with more with Captain Jim Fennell right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. it's obvious that Joe Biden is not actually performing the duties of the President of the United States. His calendar scarcely has anything on it. He's mostly off duty in Delaware or Camp David, and even when he's nominally working, he's clearly doing the bidding of unidentified others who are actually making the decisions. This is a national disgrace and a grievous departure from the principle of representative and accountable governance that is at the heart of our constitutional republic. Now, it has become a real national security threat. On four separate occasions, Joe Biden has declared that the United States would defend Taiwan if it were attacked by Communist China. All four times, he was swiftly countermanded again by unnamed White House officials. Such behavior emboldens our enemies and intensifies the danger of an avoidable war. It must stop now. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We're continuing a conversation that I always prize when we have the opportunity to catch up with Captain James Fennell, United States Navy, retired former chief of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet. He's one of our country's, I think, most thoughtful analysts of and, well, champions concerning the need for our diligent attention to the Chinese Communist Party threat and responses to it. And Jim, I didn't give you enough time to really respond properly before the break there, but do you believe, as I do, that the Chinese are interpreting this dance between the president and the White House as not just strategic ambiguity that really slightly but not terribly completely conceals a determination to resist China, but a strategic incoherence that almost certainly bespeaks a lack of will, if not capability, to do anything about it, should it attack Taiwan, or for that matter, even our bases or assets in the Pacific as well?
Yes, Frank. I think you can examine in the 60 Minutes presentation that President Biden made, he made a comment about that the pandemic is over. And today in Global Times, there's the number one top op-ed in Global Times today is quite long and extensive. And the PRC, the Chinese Communist Party, clearly were stunned by that statement. And they spent an extraordinary amount of time debunking that statement and saying that the pandemic cannot be over and we must maintain these controls. So they reacted immediately in response and very aggressively to that statement. Whereas when
Global Times is, of course, one of their major publications, propaganda outlets,
in the heart of the Chinese Communist Party, even though it's not an official, you know, government statement, it speaks to what they think. And on the other hand, they had almost no response to President Biden's statement about defending Taiwan with American soldiers. So that should tell people what that really means by what they say, but also by their actions. And in their actions, they have ramped up their actions against Taiwan. They haven't stopped. So in the 2 years that we've had this administration in Washington, China has actually increased its actions to show that it's ready to take militarily Taiwan. So I would say it's not a matter of did we maintain the status quo of strategic ambiguity. I think these four statements now in the immediate walkbacks by unidentified White House spokespersons has actually sent the signal to Beijing that we're not going to defend Taiwan. That's the really dangerous message.
Jim, talk a little bit more about what you've been witnessing and chronicling through the Chinese press as well as other observers concerning the ongoing buildup of the Chinese military. I know that you are admiring, grudgingly, but admiring nonetheless, of the enormous shipbuilding production that they've been engaged in, including of what amount to cruisers and submarines that are unmistakably changing the balance of power in the Pacific, if not globally just yet. But talk about this in the context particularly of possible imminent hostilities, at least post-Party Congress.
Right. It's my assessment that the PLA has the capability and wherewithal to conduct an invasion of Taiwan. And I know that many in Washington do not necessarily agree with that. But my assessment is that they do have a capability to conduct a successful invasion of Taiwan. And it doesn't necessarily have to follow the 1940s invasion of Normandy or the 1950s invasion of Incheon. It's a different era, different weapons, and different systems. And so I think that what they've built is a force that's capable of achieving the goals that they've set out through the technologies that we have today, the missile systems that they have today with the strategic rocket force, the air superiority that they will surely put over the island, and the fact that they're inching closer and closer and flying in the face of Taiwan on a daily basis. And so the element of surprise will be on their side in many ways. And so
that's such a key point, Jim. And I think most of us civilians don't really get it. But as we've discussed before, when you keep pushing the envelope, as they say, you keep exercising relentlessly your capacity to enter that airspace, operate inside it, and the waters for that matter as well, the indicators and warnings of actually going to war from that position diminish greatly, don't they?
Right. And I think there's been an assumption on our side, and certainly when I was in uniform, that we would have, you know, anywhere from 14 days to a month or even 60 days of indications and warning, because there's this belief that, well, they're going to have to mass up millions of people like we did in England before we went across to Normandy. And I think what the Chinese are doing on a daily basis, we're hearing reports now that Chinese warships are operating off the East Coast, off the main base of Suao on a daily basis. So we're being normalized to accept this kind of level of presence by PLA warships and fighters and bombers and reconnaissance aircraft all in and around Taiwan on a daily basis. And the more that goes on, the harder it is for Taiwan and certainly for the United States or allies like Japan to be able to respond to this, because we're being worn down. So there's a wearing down of our force structure, and our force structure, as we, you know, previously said, is less than China's in certain areas, especially like in naval forces and strategic rocket forces, and you could even argue in air forces. Virtually across the spectrum of military kinetic power, China overmatches the Taiwans and the United States and Japan today. And so when they constantly are coming at them, it makes it much harder for us to really see when the big strike would come.
15 seconds, unfortunately, is all we've got. How important is it, in light of all that, that we be upgrading immediately and massively Taiwan's self-defense capabilities?
I think it's absolutely critically important, and maybe we need to start deploying American forces onto Taiwan right now.
I hate to leave it at that, but we will be back with more with you, Jim Fennell, in the very near future, I hope. Thank you very much for your time today, sir, and your extraordinary and continuing service to our country. It's deeply appreciated. God bless you, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Peter McIlvenna about the succession in the British Crown right after this.
bombs and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and we are joined by a guest that we have talked with off and on, but not for a frightfully long time. His name is Peter McIlvenna. He is hailing from the United Kingdom, where he works with a great friend of this program and mine personally, Malcolm Pearson, Lord Malcolm Pearson, in an organization called Hearts of Oak. Peter has been very much in evidence of late, as we have been watching with great fixation in the case of a lot of Americans, the succession from Queen Elizabeth, may she rest in peace, to her son, King Charles. We are interested in catching up with him about that topic, among others, and always delighted to have him with us. Peter, thank you so much for joining us once again at Securing America.
Thank you, Frank, for having me on. It's great to be here.
The question, I guess, that is on my mind is not so much the passing of the Queen, much regretted and lamented, as much as it is what is to be expected of her successor. She was a pretty much private person. She played her official roles with great decorum, but she was not, you know, out and about espousing causes and policy initiatives and otherwise engaging the crown in lots of political fights. Her son seems to be rather differently wired, and I'm interested in your thoughts both as to whether that will likely characterize his reign. And if so, what are the causes that we're likely to see him throwing himself into?
Well, Prince Charles, now King Charles III, he became king the moment Queen Elizabeth II died. We know quite a bit about him, but also whoever comes next is a massive change, because we've had 70 years of continuity. That's unheard of. Your viewers, if they're based in the US, that's a concept that's quite foreign, to have 70 years of continuity at the top of a nation. And she has gone. As you said, she kept her feelings, she kept her advice personal behind closed doors. And I think it was Tony Blair that said the one person he knew that would never leak was the Queen, that there was that private conversation. The Prime Minister could unload their concerns in their weekly meetings and would have that input from someone who's probably met more heads of state around the world than anybody else. She has now gone. So whoever came next, it would be a big change. 70 years, we've changed massively as a society during that 70 years, and we face uncertain times moving forward. Prince Charles is, he's known, he would be writing regularly to the local papers his feelings about many issues. He is not a Christian. Again, that, as a Christian, that concerns me. The Queen talked regularly about her faith. As a Christian, her faith in Jesus, she talked about at Christmas time regularly. That was her anchor. Charles, King Charles III, does not have that same anchor. That reflects, I guess, public change, public opinion, but it means we have someone who is now on the throne who does not have that same foundation, and his views are very different from his mother, the Queen.
Yeah, you know, I was struck in intermittently watching the funeral yesterday, the day before, I guess now, the Queen's, you know, commitment to her Christian faith was palpable. I mean, it was very much the focus of the ceremony. And when you say he's not a Christian, there have been some who have seen in his very public admiration for Islam an affinity, if not actually, in some rumors, an actual conversion. This is quite remarkable for a guy who, by title, is the head of the Church of England, the Anglican Church. You follow closely the phenomenon of Sharia supremacism, as I think it's best described, in the United Kingdom. What are we to make of Charles III and this particular part of the portfolio, do you think?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is often we don't know what happens behind the scenes. We are the public and we are looking in and we are told information that may or may not be true. We don't get a peek behind the curtain. And who knows what happens in private. Now, the other part of the answer is that he doesn't have a Christian faith. He is very much a New Age figure, very much accepting anything, curious about everything, doesn't have that stability. So we'll go here and there very much into whatever the latest thinking may be. Because of that, I know he certainly has a curiosity. Now, I don't know whether I could say any stronger than a curiosity. It may be an affection, I don't know. I mean, Tony Blair used to say that he had the Quran by his bedside and he would read it for peace and comfort. I do not know which Quran he was reading.
Yeah. Selected quotes, I think.
Exactly. Now, King Charles, he has never said that. That could be wisdom on his side, because he knew that he was being prepared for this role. He has lived all his life for this role, to be king of the United Kingdom. So even if he had adopted, even if he had converted from being, I guess, an atheist to a Muslim, we probably wouldn't know. My big concern is that we will see a massive change in our society in the UK. The Queen, as head of the Church of England, the Church of England is no longer a Christian anchor in the UK. Archbishop Welby is a, well, Wet Welby, as I sometimes refer to him. I think that explains it all. He's at sea and will listen to 20 opinions before he comes up with what he thinks himself. And so we don't have stability in the Church of England as the national church. Now, when Charles comes in, I don't know how that will go. I could see actually the link being cut between the Church of England, the established church, and the monarchy, the British state. And what we accept, I think, will be everything and anything. I think Charles will embrace anything, and it certainly will be Islam, but may not be exclusively Islam, but it will just be a court where he will be defender of faiths, any belief system you have, and not the one faith. That's where I think we're heading, and that certainly concerns me.
One other aspect of his public activity in his previous role as the Prince of Wales has been his strong engagement on the so-called climate change or green agenda. Britain is headed into a very difficult period with energy shortages seeming in the offing. The new Prime Minister, Liz Truss, has taken some steps, some good, some not so good in this regard. Talk a little bit about Charles's record as an environmental activist, and whether you anticipate that that too will be a leitmotif of his new role.
Well, on this, I think probably Greta Thunberg would be his advisor. That thinking of net zero, of reducing our so-called dependence on fossil fuels and over to others. Now, the thing is, the UK have, it's been a stop start in this. If they wanted to do this, then we could have built tons of windmills out just on the edge of the Scottish Hebrides. We get a lot of wind in from the Atlantic. Wonderful. Yes, but Britain have never even embraced that. So at least by doing that, you would have helped your own economy. That doesn't happen. I think it's Holland makes most of the windmills or elsewhere. So, but Charles Chinese, will certainly...
The Chinese.
But Charles will certainly push on that. He will, where the Queen was there to listen and offer advice, Charles will be there to more push an agenda. And that certainly is net zero. That is punishing motorists. That is punishing businesses. That is, we have our electricity bills, like many parts of the world, have increased probably three times in the last 18 to 20 months. And there, we don't have any spare capacity, probably 1.5% spare capacity. We run at 98% of usage of our energy. We aren't building nuclear. We are confused whether we should have more gas or less. We don't really have a lot of sun in the UK. So it's really windmills will be the one that we choose. And Charles will...
But even in the Hebrides, I think that's not baseload power, unfortunately. No. It certainly isn't most elsewhere in the world. And I guess the question, just to wrap up, because we're almost out of time, Peter McAvenant, is if the King of England puts his crown, if you will, behind this idea of pushing this green agenda and... you know, causing, well, the kind of harm that you've talked about, intensifying it. Is this likely to greatly increase the crisis that your country faces in the months to come?
Well, the one positive thing about our new Prime Minister, Liz Truss, and the kind of balance against Charles's net zero environmentalism destruction of the UK is that she is a more conservative figure. She has said we need to remove the restriction on fracking. We need to look at North Sea oil and gas. And she has certainly pushed for that. So I think that's the one positive thing from Liz Truss, the new Prime Minister. She isn't unknown, but I think she will start those industries again. North Sea oil and gas was a massive industry in the UK, and that will be restarted and we could be energy reliant once again. That's what I'm hoping for, and she's made good noises on that.
We'll be watching that closely, and we'll look forward to visiting with you about it and more. Thank you very much for your time today. Peter McAvenant, Hearts of Oak, give our very best to Lord Pearson, and thank you for the work you all are doing. Next up, we'll speak with Christine Douglas-Williams. We'll get an update on Canada and also the Middle East right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It's obvious that Joe Biden is not actually performing the duties of the President of the United States. His calendar scarcely has anything on it. He's mostly off duty in Delaware or Camp David, and even when he's nominally working, he's clearly doing the bidding of unidentified others who are actually making the decisions. This is a national disgrace and a grievous departure from the principle of representative and accountable governance that is at the heart of our constitutional republic. Now, it has become a real national security threat. On four separate occasions, Joe Biden has declared that the United States would defend Taiwan if it were attacked by Communist China. All four times, he was swiftly countermanded again by unnamed White House officials. Such behavior emboldens our enemies and intensifies the danger of an avoidable war. It must stop now. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. We are joined by one of our duty experts on our neighbor to the north, Canada, among many other things. Her name is Christine Douglas-Williams. She is a 9-time international award-winning journalist and TV producer. She is also an author, including the important book, The Challenge of Modernizing Islam, and a very, very prolific essayist, notably at Jihad Watch and Front Page Magazine, I think at PJ Media and other outlets. And we're always delighted to catch up with her. Christine, welcome back to Securing America.
It's a pleasure to be back, Frank.
Thank you. I look to you, of course, always, first and foremost, as a monitor of what is happening in Canada. Our own Tucker Carlson has been talking about its sort of descent into totalitarianism with the suppression of free speech and the disarming of citizens and freedom of assembly going over the side and the like. There's been some promising news, though, and I'd like to get that as well as an update on the not so good.
Big news going on in Canada, Frank, and the rising star in Canada is Pierre Poilievre. Canada. Now, in Canada, for Americans who really do not follow Canadian politics, but they want to know the ABCs, the official opposition party in Canada is the Conservative Party of Canada, which unfortunately has suffered some setbacks over the past few years when it comes to leadership. For instance, there was Andrew Scheer, who didn't make it. He eventually left. Then there was another fellow that he was too far left. And when you look at Erin O'Toole, during particularly the Freedom Truck Convoy protests, he was not standing by the truckers. But even more than that, it started before that. He was being deemed a fellow that was a little too far left for grassroots conservatives. So along comes Pierre Poilievre after Erin O'Toole was chucked from that party, and he is now the official leader of the opposition. He made history because based on Canadian ballots, there are several possible rounds of balloting based on how the first round goes. He won in the first round of balloting with a 68%. Now that was even higher than Stephen Harper when he first won. So this guy is a rising star, and needless to say, he is the target of the mainstream media.
Tell us a little bit about his background and why he is a rising star.
Now, there's a really interesting background with Pierre Poilievre because this guy is known as the kid, the whippersnapper that joined the political scene from the time he was in his 20s. Even before that, he was interested in politics. And he ended up in politics, the youngest MP, as far as I know, in Canada. And he was in his late 20s when he finally became a member of parliament. And he was known at the time as being somebody that the left would describe as quite aggressive, pulling people up by their bootstraps, challenging them. But as time went on, he became more and more suave. He became an efficient communicator. And even his detractors on what is traditionally considered the left media would agree that he is, in fact, an exceptional communicator. So this is where we see a bit of a difference in the Canadian media than we see perhaps in the American media when it comes to going after Trump. They are relentless in the U.S. Yes, there's a bit of antagonism, quite a bit, and excessive scrutiny of Pierre Poilievre. But in Canada, you do find some fairness as well. There is that recognition that he is a rising star. And watch out, Trudeau, you finally have a contender for the next election set for October 2025.
Okay. And so in the interval, a lot of damage can be done given what Trudeau has been about in recent months, let alone if he's got a couple more years. Is there any possibility that these elections might be held sooner?
I can't see that happening because Trudeau, it wouldn't go to his favor, especially at this point. In fact, it's a very interesting question and an important one that you ask. And 1 week alone, the conservative support for conservatives jumped by 5%. So according to polls, and we can't always go by polls, we know that, we saw it in 2016 in America, he is now leading by some 35%, the Liberals trailing 30%. So Pierre Poilievre. So it wouldn't behoove Trudeau to have an election now. In terms of how much damage that could be done in the next few years, a lot can be done. But here's where the catch-22 is. Trudeau now finds himself in the position where, politically speaking and strategically, it would behoove him to be the good boy to get some people on his side who have been totally against him, even what you would call moderate liberals, for what you've been seeing going on in Canada, where he has been described quite frequently as totalitarian in tendencies. So he's faced on one side with wanting to be the good guy, so it wouldn't behoove him to be his usual Trudeau self, breaking ethics, spending money like it's his own when it's taxpayer money, and violating people's constitutional rights. On the other hand, he also pulled a strategic coalition with the NDP government, which is an underhanded way of trumping Canada's democracy, and signing a pact with the NDP, giving him an essential majority in the House on all major issues and guaranteeing that he will survive any possible vote of no confidence motion in the House. So
now, why just explain that a little bit for those of us who aren't familiar with parliamentary practice. How is it underhanded? I thought coalition building is what happens all the time in parliamentary systems, does it not?
Not that kind of coalition building. Canada is in a system where each party goes head to head when it comes to elections. A certain member of the population votes for the parliament and for the MP in their riding. And it was Trudeau that won, not a majority like he expected to win when he pulled a fast election. And the NDP were trailing. They didn't stand a chance. And then, of course, there was the official opposition, the Conservatives. So when it comes to passing motions in Parliament, because Trudeau did not have enough seats in the House of Commons to ensure that his major policies, such as a budget, because if a budget doesn't pass, that will result in the fall of a government, or if, let's say, an MP decides to conjure up a no confidence motion, the government could fall. Before you know it, he's out of office. So what he did was that this is a pact he formed with the NDP. And this is something that's generally not seen in Canada, where there was an agreement that you, meaning the NDP guy, Singh, would back up every major bill in the House when it comes to the budget, when it comes to the major bills that really make a difference, including no confidence motions, and you will back me. And he swore to that. So that ended up being a pact, ensuring that he trumped the parliamentary system, the fair democratic system, if you will.
And the give and take that might have resulted in another
and the fall of his government.
Election faster. Yeah. Christine Douglas-Williams, we'll be right back with more. We're going to talk about Iran next, right after this. Welcome back. We are visiting with Christine Douglas-Williams, a very accomplished journalist and author and essayist hailing from Canada, where she has quite courageously spoken truth to power in an environment that is increasingly dangerous, frankly, for people trying to do that. Freedom of speech is no longer a given in her native Canada, alas. But she is also contributing mightily to the public policy debate in our country, notably through platforms like jihadwatch.org and others. Christine, I did want to ask you about reporting you've been doing lately from Iran. It seems as though there is once again evidence of real public unrest with respect to the regime of the Ayatollahs and their Sharia supremacist government. Give us the latest on both what women in particular are now doing to express their opposition to the regime and whether there's a chance that this might actually threaten, taken altogether, that is, the future of this theocracy.
There is one pattern, Frank, that we see in Iran going on in the news cycle, and that is Iran has the audacity, and its president, Raisi, known as the Butcher of Baghdad, presenting the latest death of a dissenter. This lady, this lovely lady that decided not to wear her hijab, was taken aside by the morality police and beaten to death. And Iran
this is
denying
massive immunity, right?
Iran is denying that the morality police did that and claiming that she died a natural death. So Iran is going through upheavals right now in protests, and it doesn't help it when it comes to the global impression it would like to leave, particularly given the Iran deal that it is trying so desperately to get on its own terms. And this country, the audacity of this country, it actually came right out. Never mind the proof that Israel has given again and again that it lied throughout about the Iran deal. Iran came out and admitted that it lied about the Iran deal. The atomic energy
specifically lied about the fact that it was pursuing
that it was pursuing a bomb, uranium enrichment was toward bomb making. It was flaunting its making of that bomb. The International Atomic Energy Agency came right out and said the only way you see that kind of enrichment is in countries making bombs, but it's flexing its muscle, trying now to sue America on the international court plane to say that sanctions is ruining its country, and trying to give an impression that it cares about women. For goodness sakes, Iran is the worst human rights violator. It is the worst country when it comes to dealing with its women, if they dare even begin to try to stand up for its rights. And many people are asking, well, where's the Iran deal right now? Well, it looked at one point like it was going to happen, particularly that Biden didn't know what he was doing. At one point, he gave it over to Russia. At another point, he gave it over to Qatar. And then all of a sudden, he is just sitting there. Nobody knows where he is. And now, all of a sudden, after meeting with Israel, he comes out and announces and promises Israel that it doesn't look that an Iran deal is going to be signed anytime soon. But Iran is working hard behind the scenes to try to give an impression about its country as if anybody would believe it. And of course, Israel is also working to make sure that it does not obtain that bomb, and working to make sure that there is no Iran deal, by which, by the way, Israel is not obliged to follow.
Yeah. Let's tease out some of these pieces. The Iranians, you're saying they're working hard at, you know, spinning their image. I think there's every reason to believe they're also working hard at finishing the nuclear program so that they actually have a weapon. Some of our colleagues have been convinced that they actually do have one or more already, but they certainly are in a position to have one at any time, given the amount of highly enriched uranium they now have. And when you recognize, as you have, Christine, that the mask has sort of slipped, or the veil, if I could call it that, on the actual purpose of the nuclear program in Iran, it seems absolutely harebrained to be continuing to pursue, let alone offering immense concessions to the Iranians on sanctions and access to technology and so much more money that the Biden team has been doing. And so it would be very good news if, in fact, this thing is not going forward, but I don't know whether to credit it. It seems as though it changes day by day. Is it your sense that the Biden administration is still as excited or as keen, as determined as ever to finish this transaction?
It looks to me, when following the news, Frank, and reading what the pundits are saying, that all the Biden team is trying to do is win elections. Whatever it takes, whatever it means to get the public confidence, they're willing to do. If it means telling people, lying to people and saying, look, an Iran deal keeps us safer, they will do it however they can. Then when the next poll comes out and people don't believe it, then they won't sign a deal. If people believe it, they'll sign a deal. That's the only thing I could come to, that the Biden administration wants to win elections at any cost, and whatever it takes, they will do. They have no idea, it has no idea what it's doing. And it's all about power politics.
Christine, it seems to me there's a little bit more purpose to this than that. I mean, there's no question that they are anxious to get an electoral victory this fall. But it seems as though, especially given that you've got essentially all of these retreads from the Obama years, who brought us this disastrous Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the so-called Iran deal the first time around, who are absolutely intent on doing another one. And I'm not quite clear what their motives are. It can't be actually disarming Iran, because that's not going to happen, obviously. But it's very troubling. And as you say, against the backdrop of this renewed evidence of real popular unrest and hatred even for this regime, whatever it is we're doing, whenever it is we're doing it, and with whatever concessions we have in mind doing it, it seems so completely at odds with our actual national interests, which would be, I believe, helping the people of Iran get rid of this regime rather than perpetuating, indeed propping it up, which is, I'm afraid, the effect of this.
Frank, there's also the
addition. We have to leave it at that. I'm out of time. You know the problem. Thank you so much, Christine Douglas Williams. You're the best. We look forward to further visits with you in the near future. Keep up the great work.
Thank you, Frank.
Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us in doing just that, and that you will go forth and multiply.